Good evening and welcome to the forum. Tonight we continue our speaker series from the Kicking the Coke Habit Conference. Tonight we bring you Nancy McLean, author of Democracy in Chains. Coincidentally enough, today is Nancy's 59th birthday. Let's go to Kim Claus for her introduction.
Hi, I'm Kim Claus. I'm one of the many hosts of the Heartland Labor Forum, which airs on KKFI Thursday evenings at 6 o'clock. I'm honored to be able to read books and interview authors like our speaker today. Once in a while, my interviews are also aired on Radioactive Magazine, which airs on KKFI Tuesday evenings at 6 o'clock. History is important. Historians are very important. They tell us where we've been and where we do and do not want to go. Great historians, great tellers of truth, are invaluable. Sometimes the stories they tell us are not the ones they thought they were going to tell when they started their research. Nancy McLean, the William H. Chase Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University and author of Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, is just that, an amazing historian and writer. It's not the story she set out to tell, but the story she did tell was every bit as terrifying as it was fascinating. Booklist called Democracy in Chains perhaps the best explanation to date of the roots of the political divide that threatens to irrevocably alter the American government. The Guardian said, "It's the missing chapter, a key to understanding the politics of the past half century." And Bill Claus said, "Holy crap, that was scarier than Stephen King." And I agree. And the reason it's so scary is because it's a true story. Democracy in Chains is like a textbook for every social justice activist in this room. If your issue is preventing environmental disaster, you need to read this book. If your issue is protecting public education, you need to read this book. If your issue is preventing the dismantlement of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, you need to read this book. If your issue has anything at all to do with helping our country kick the Coke habit and expand democracy for all, you need to read this book. I could go on, but I won't. Instead, without further ado, it is my great pleasure to give you author, historian, and dynamic speaker, Nancy McLean.
Hey, everyone. First of all, thank you, Kim, for that fabulous introduction. I think it's my favorite ever. I also want to thank Judy and Bill and Kim and all the many volunteers who are here today for pulling us all together in this amazing gathering. And also I want to say that I've not been to any kind of political gathering of late that's had so much cultural work involved in it. And so that's really been a pleasure, and it's just great to be with you all here today. We'll start, I think, with a prediction that may surprise you, and that is that I think that when historians look back on our moment 50 years from now and try to make sense of it, I don't think they'll be focusing on Donald Trump. I think they'll be more interested in a quiet yet radical transformation underway in our country that his conduct is distracting attention from. And that is an ingenious, slow takeover by the Koch-led political right of core branches of our government, beginning at the state level and moving on to the federal courts, with assistance from an infrastructure of hundreds of well-funded national and state organizations and campus outposts. Those organizations include many names familiar to you, such as the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and the Federalist Society at the national level. They include state-level policy and legal groups whose work is aligned through the state policy network, such as your own Show Me Institute, I believe they call it in Missouri. They include organizing enterprises such as Americans for Prosperity, Concerned Veterans for America, the Libre Institute, and Generation Opportunity. And they include a growing network of, a growing number of college and university-based centers of allied faculty members. And in an earlier workshop this morning, we were talking about the fact that Koch money is now going to 300 colleges and universities around the country. Now, whether future analysts who are looking back on our moment are reporting on the success of this audacious bid to transform our society and government, or whether they're looking at the impressive, inspired 11th hour organizing that stymied that bid, they will either way, I think, have to credit the genius of the Koch long game. And they will trace how the quiet focus of Charles Koch and his allies on first destroying the power of its targets and then radically altering the rules of the political process enabled the progression of this once marginal cause that is still not popular with more than about 3% of the population when they know what it's really about, enabled the progression of this takeover to the point we see today, which none of us in this room would have predicted in 2008, if you can remember back to that moment. So, what I want to do today, though, is not tell you the story of my book, but rather talk a bit about the value added from my research for activists like yourselves who are daily dealing with the impact that of the strategy that my research traced. And I will state my case plainly, and that is that we are faced with a paradox on the left. On issue after issue, progressives have won majority backing, whether it's for action on the planet, whether it's reproductive rights, whether it is workers' rights and support for public education and improved teacher salaries. Everywhere we have the majority on our side. And we're very good at winning local campaigns and sometimes state campaigns, but we have been steadily losing power now for a couple decades. And I believe that we are losing power and that the right is winning precisely because the Koch network has effectively weaponized the ideas of a figure who is little known to the mainstream or to the left, but who supply the crucial ideas that are in play today, much as Milton Friedman's ideas were in play for an early era of the right. This figure's name is James McGill Buchanan. He was the first U.S. Southerner to win the Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences for his economic analysis of government and what he called constitutional economics. If you've never heard of him, don't feel bad. Most people have not. I had not until I stumbled on him in the course of my research, but he turns out to be pretty significant. And he is significant because the right is using strategies informed by the ideas of Buchanan's school to undermine the collective power on which liberal and progressive policies depend, and then to rig the rules in their own favor at every step. As Charles Koch put it to the latest donor summit this spring, and I quote, "We have made more progress over the last 5 years than I was able to make over the previous 50. So he's been at this for a very long time and suddenly succeeding. Now, by following these ideas that enabled that success through from their crucible in the era of massive resistance to Brown versus Board of Education in Virginia, as I stumbled onto this story years ago and carried through in the book, I think we gain at least three important resources. The first of those is a deep understanding of the Koch network's operational strategy, including how that operational strategy might be blunted. The second is a history that exposes why the libertarian right adopted this strategy. And that was precisely because its architects knew that the majority would stop their plan if they understood it. And I actually believe that is the single most important finding of my research, is to find these guys saying again and again in their own words that they know they are a permanent minority. They know the people do not want the world they're trying to bring into being, and that is why they've turned to stealth. Third, I think we gain knowledge of their ultimate endgame, which is an incredibly radical transformation of our governing institutions, our legal system, and our social norms. A transformation that would force total personal responsibility for everything by undercutting our capacity to do the kinds of things that citizens have looked to government for help with, from public health to economic security to regulating errant corporations to all the other kinds of things that we've done over the generations. The Koch Donor Network, in short, seeks to enchain democracy, hence the title of my book, Democracy in Chains. The plan is, over time, to bind our political processes in such a way as to make government unable to comply with the will of the people, at least where that majority will involves tax transfers and regulation. So what we're seeing here is far more than partisan. This is not about Democrats versus Republicans. It is a messianic plan. I mean, that's the immediate case. I don't mean to understate that, but that's just a piece of it. This is a messianic plan, decades in the making, to fundamentally change the relationship between the government and the people, and to do so permanently. That is what they are seeking. That is what they want to achieve, is permanent, irreversible change. So to grasp why having this plan of action matters, let me quote the head of Koch Industries Government and Public Affairs Operation, a man named Mark Holden, gloating to a donor summit in late 2015. He said this, "We're close to winning. They," he was talking about critics of the Koch network, but he might as well have been talking about the rest of the citizenry, "they don't have the real path. They don't have the real path." I believe that I found that real path in my research through a host of serendipitous coincidences, which we can talk about informally maybe later, but I did find that path. And it starts with gaining control over an ever-growing number of states to the point where this network now controls 30 states. It then moves through those state legislatures to alter the rules of the political process in each one in a manner that will ultimately choke progressive policy nationally and at the local level too. So among the pivotal changes are these. Redistricting to ensure minority rule. The most sophisticated gerrymander we have ever seen in our history that is enabling these right-wing Republican legislators to choose their voters instead of letting us, the voters, choose our legislators. Hamstringing labor unions, particularly public sector unions and particularly teachers unions, because they are the most powerful and progressive unions in today's America and because they are powerful lobbying forces defending the rest of the liberal state and popular achievements over the generations. Also undermining other strong liberal lobbies such as Planned Parenthood. This is not simply a war against women by a bunch of old sexists. This is a very strategic effort to take out a key lobby for public health and for government spending on those of us who are not wealthy and have healthcare needs. Then, with these core power bases of the enemy, as they think of the rest of us, enfeebled, the strategy moves on to the next phase. With voter suppression, the likes of which we have not seen since the destruction of black political power at the turn of the 20th century, with preemption of local progressive wins on everything from anti-discrimination to living wages to environmental protections, and privatization of public resources to alter power relations in a lasting way. There's more, but these are some of the main elements. So what is this real path driving toward that the progressive side has missed? The ultimate rules change, altering the US Constitution at the first and only state-convened constitutional convention we have had since the Constitution was ratified. The goal is to amend the Constitution in a manner that would rule out in advance most of what progressive social movements have accomplished, not just since the 1960s, not just since the 1930s, since the 1910s. Now, this may sound exaggerated, this may sound crazy even. You might be saying, why did they bring her here? I hear you. How many of you watched Homeland, that Netflix series? You know that? Okay. And there's for those of you who didn't, there's a CIA analyst named Carrie, what is her name? Carrie, help me out, friends. Carrie, whatever. Okay, so Carrie. There's Claire Danes. Anyway, she's a CIA analyst, and she's seeing something that other people aren't seeing, and she's suspecting this guy, and blah, blah, blah. And she's got all these charts and files, and anyway, and you all find out that she's also manic depressive, right? And she's like off her meds. So it's like, is she really seeing something, or should she be on medication? I have to tell you, that is the way I was feeling when I was doing this research at a particular point in 2011 and 2012 before I got into Buchanan's archives. It's like, no, this couldn't be going on. No one would do something so audacious. That is crazy. It's impossible. It can't be. And I really started to question myself. I thought, this is crazy. And then I got into the archives, and she was right. I was too. When I got into the archives, it was clear. And let me say this. While the eyes of journalists and citizens have been fixated almost exclusively for the last few years on Donald Trump, organizations and elected officials funded by Charles Koch and his donor network, with ALEC in the lead, the American Legislative Exchange Council, have been lining up the authorizations needed to convene such a convention. They now have the backing of 28 of the 34 states required to call a constitutional convention, and there are 6 states in which Republicans control both houses of the legislature where they have not yet authorized a convention: Idaho, Kentucky, Minnesota, Montana, South Carolina, and Virginia. Okay, so a little background. Article 5 of the US Constitution provides 2 routes to amendment. One, through Congress, which we've seen now, there's 27 amendments, most of them are good things. There were a couple of dumb ones like prohibition that aren't there anymore, but you know, we're familiar with that method. And the other provision, the other way to amend the Constitution is by this convention of the states. This has never been tried before, precisely because it is so radical. Any such convention would necessarily be a runaway convention because there's no way to control it. The Constitution only specifies how you get people there. And we should be aware that the right already has 10 liberty amendments, as they call them, queued up and ready to go at such a convention. If you were to Google liberty amendments, you'll find them. You'll find that there was a book that was a bestseller on the right by Mark Levin, a Koch-funded legal strategist and radio talk show host. So they know what they want. And now, as it happens, this second option is in the Constitution thanks to George Mason, who urged its inclusion out of fear that the power of the national government might be used against slave states, such as his own Virginia. And as coincidence would have it, and it is a coincidence, George Mason University is today the intellectual base camp of the Koch political operation. Right across the Potomac from Washington, D.C., in a public university, they have an economics department lining up the game plan with help from the donors. The Mercatus Center, as it's called, pushing out policies to Congress and the states and running training for congressional staff, legal staff, etc. And they have the renamed Scalia School of Law advancing the case for the kind of Gilded Age restoration constitution favored by the Koch network. So what kind of a country would we live in if this libertarian dream constitution came into being? In the sources that I consulted in my research, they were quite clear about this, particularly this figure, Buchanan. That dream constitution would create an America quite like the America of 1900, a place where workers had no right to organize for collective voice, a place where corporations were free of democratic accountability, whether for discrimination or pollution or consumer protection, a place of mass voter suppression, and of course, a place with no Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid or any of the other things that we have come to appreciate over the generations since then. But here we come to another puzzle, which is not even the voters who are sticking by the current president would want to live in this world, right? Nobody, almost nobody, would want to live in the world I just described. So how exactly could the Koch-led right carry out a transformation to this kind of world in a functioning democracy. That's, I think, where my research brings something very new to the table. The operational strategy that Koch and his field generals have devised to surmount this pretty considerable obstacle, I learned, depends on stealth. It proceeds through a series of what Koch calls interrelated plays, incremental changes that build on one another in a cumulative manner, so that this cause never has to inform the people of its true endgame, or even be honest about the purpose of each play that moves the overall project closer to its conclusion. And here, for a case that will be familiar, you could think of Governor Scott Walker and Bill 10, right? The budget repair bill, whose real purpose was to destroy the collective voice of working people in Wisconsin. Okay, again, why stealth? This is crucial to understand. That is because they know from repeated historical experience that the majority would never knowingly support their true vision. This cause's first candidate was Barry Goldwater in 1964. We don't think of him that way, but his domestic agenda was completely neoliberal, free market, fundamentalistic economics. And the only states he won were the states that practiced mass voter suppression in his home state of Arizona. Ronald Reagan disappointed them. George W. Bush disappointed them, etc. They know that any elected officials who try to carry this vision will face pushback from the voters. So they've got to do it another way. As Charles Koch said when he launched this effort in earnest in 1997, and I quote, "Since we are greatly outnumbered, the failure to use our superior technology ensures failure," right? So he's acknowledging they are greatly outnumbered, they are a tiny minority. But what is this superior technology he's talking about? This was the ideas he found in the school of thought developed by James Buchanan, that first US Southerner to win the Nobel Prize. And you could say that Buchanan's school of thought fused the white political conservatism he grew up imbibing in Tennessee with the libertarian economics he learned as a doctoral student at the University of Chicago after World War II. But the moment he began creating this school of thought was also telling. And that was just as Virginia was leading the white South in massive resistance to Brown versus Board of Education. It was at that moment that James Buchanan was hired as the new chair of economics department at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And there, backed by the state's elite and the leading funder of free market fundamentalism at the time, a local group, by the way, the William Volcker Fund, which is the direct predecessor to Charles Koch's favorite academic philanthropy, the Institute for Humane Studies, backed by this elite, this very right-wing elite, Buchanan began crafting a set of potent ideas that would counter the New Deal and the emerging civil rights movement at their very source, and that is the then widespread belief in government and trust that government could fix market failure for the common good. His strategy was to take dead aim at that trust, to aid a right that was marginalized. And he understood something that figures like Milton Friedman did not. Milton Friedman thought you could just go on about how great markets were and how wonderful they were and how bad government was, and you would persuade people. Buchanan was no dummy. He grew up in rural Tennessee. You know, the TVA brought electrification, right? People depended on the New Deal. They needed those resources. They believed in him. He knew the more strategic long game was to discredit government, right? Was to take out people's belief that democratic government could be on their side. And he did this by applying his Chicago economics training to argue that we had to see government and public actors as just like market actors, only seeking their own self-interest, right? That's what he said. So all elected officials, agency officials, union leaders, civil rights leaders, anyone you could pick who would be an actor in public would not really be in it for the common good or the public good, as they said, but really just for their own personal self-interest. And with that argument, he said, therefore, government can't do any of the things we rely on it to because it's sort of broken by its nature, by this individual self-seeking. So it was a very shrewd argument. I should say it was not an empirical argument. It's all theoretical. It's all game theory and all this other stuff. But it was very persuasive to people on his side and to some in the academy. And it was directly political from the start. It was the origins of this makers versus takers vocabulary that we hear so much about, right? And in his terms, it was even more chilling. He spoke of predators and prey, right? That the productive contributors, those today called the job creators, were being victimized, were being preyed on by these predators and parasites. Who might they be? Well, of course, teachers, you know, trying to get funding for public education, old people trying to get, you know, better retirement benefits or prescription drug benefits, you know, like environmentalists, all these people, we're the predators, right? And they're the prey, chilling stuff. So he believed that this was wrong and he set out to stop it, ultimately by designing a vision to reverse engineer the 20th century liberal state. One of his greatest gifts to the right was this advice. If you don't like the outcome of politics over a long period of time, and again, here you have to realize libertarians do not like the whole 20th century, and I'm not joking. If you don't like the outcome of politics over a long period of time, Buchanan said, stop focusing on who rules and focus instead on the rules. This is crucial to understand, and actually the left could learn something from this, right? But if you don't like the outcome of policy, stop talking about who's running for office, even focusing on the particular party. Instead, think about the rules by which the government acts and makes decisions. And in his case, it was to think about how to change them in order to serve this recalcitrant, wealthy minority. So Charles Koch noticed that Buchanan alone, among the hundreds of libertarian intellectuals that Koch funded from the 1960s forward, came up with an approach that could actually help them achieve victory, that could win in a lasting way. And by 1997, Koch concluded that this approach was the technology, in his terms, as a guy with three engineering degrees from MIT, the technology that could secure victory. And that's when he made his first $10 million gift to Buchanan Center at George Mason, where Koch is now the largest donor, calls the shots, has given over $100 million. And he made clear in the speech that accompanied that first 1997 gift just how ambitious his vision for this investment was. He said, and I quote, "I want to unleash the kind of force that propelled Columbus to his discoveries." He's also compared himself to Martin Luther. We have all felt that force since, as the organizations and elected officials backed by the Koch network have engaged in systematic radical rules change, both in the states and nationally, bringing us to the current crisis. We've seen that force in the transformation of the Republican Party, using the threat of dark money primary challenges from the right and the lure of dark money contributions in a kind of pincers action to make elected officials comply with the will of the extreme right donor class, not even their own voters. One Koch official boasts of this, what he calls the accountability play, meaning making them accountable to the donors, not the voters, as our secret sauce. We've seen that force too in how the Koch network, having harnessed a major political party to its purposes, then turned Buchanan's thought into a step-by-step strategy to transform our country into a place none of us would recognize and very few of us would want to live. This project took off in Wisconsin in early 2011 when Scott Walker proclaimed to his team, "This is our moment to change the course of history," and then applied Buchanan's ideas to undercut public sector labor unions. This was the first and most decisive of the many interrelated plays and the ones on which all the rest depended. The voter suppression, the environmental attacks, et cetera, et cetera. And Wisconsin, by the way, earlier this year became the latest state to authorize that Article 5 Constitutional Convention. In Washington, we witnessed the force that Koch unleashed in the brinkmanship applied to ensure that citizens not be given any new reasons to believe in government. Not the Affordable Care Act, not union card check, not immigration reform, not reproductive justice, not action on climate change, not common sense gun laws, nothing. And now, lo and behold, since the inauguration of Donald Trump, the Koch wish list is being granted with epic speed on almost every front, in every federal department and agency, while we're distracted by the president's tweets. Most recently, of course, the Koch scored their potentially greatest victory in the Trump administration with the nomination of their preferred candidate, Brett Kavanaugh, for the U.S. Supreme Court. So, what does all of this, this long game on the right, suggest for those of us in this room? For those of us who will not go into that good night, people who want to see a world of fairness, of justice, of sustainability, what can we do with this knowledge in our work? If we have this Koch battle plan, if we know where it's coming from, if we know why the ultimate prize is altering the U.S. Constitution, what are the action implications? Of course, we'll talk more about this in the discussion, but I'll just throw down some markers here. It means, for one thing, that just taking stands on issues like jobs or healthcare or reproductive rights or environmental protection will no longer work as it once did, because the rules have been rigged and we have to be thinking in other ways. It means that democracy itself, the defense of, preservation of, and expansion of democracy must be a key focus of everyone's work on the progressive side, and alerting the public to the profound danger democracy is in, and not simply from Donald Trump. Again, I think of him as the distractor in chief. As one public health professional who wrote me after reading the book said, Donald Trump, I see now, is the tumor, not the cancer. The cancer is the chronic problems that have allowed the Koch strategy to get as far as it has. Escalated, uncontrolled inequality that is getting worsened by all the policies they're putting into effect. Dark money in politics, obstacles to voter registration and participation, partisan gerrymandering, loss of accountability, and more. And as a historian who teaches the history of social movements in the United States, beginning with the Revolution and going through abolition and beyond, I have to say I've thought long and hard about this, and I do not see a way of getting out of this acute crisis that the Koch network has put us in without addressing these chronic problems, right? Without deep reform of the operating rules of government. Reform that enables the voters to rebuild countervailing power to the sway of extreme wealth, like that of the Koch network, and that also uses that popular power to unrig the rules, just as they have used their power to rig the rules. And here I want to say something that I think is exceedingly important to understand. The right today is not coming for any one group, right? No sweepstakes. This is not targeting any one group for which the others are rationalizations. In fact, they are coming for every people and group on the progressive side. And that's why I love Kim's introduction so much. They are coming for every labor union, every civil rights organization, every feminist organization, every consumer protection group, every environmental group, every good government group, and every retirees group. All are at risk from this strategy. Why is that? Because the strategic architects of all of this are doing what they are for a coldly calculated reason. Because all of those targets that I just named rely on the 20th century model of government, particularly since the New Deal era, a model that the right finds odious. And that is a government with the capacity to carry out the will of the people using progressive taxation and corporate regulation. So if you look at it in these terms, what you see is that the Koch-led right wants to take away the very toolkit, the toolkit that has enabled all the popular successes of the 20th century, right? From consumer protection and labor standards to public health to retirement security to workplace diversity to anti-discrimination measures to clean air and water and marriage equality, all of those things are at risk. But here's the kind of fun irony that history is full of, which is why I love being a historian. It protects you from depression. Because you can look back and you can see all these other things. And what I see when I look at this is that I see this tremendous irony. In trying to take away our common toolkit, this Koch-led right might just have done for the progressive side what we have been so unable to do for ourselves for years now. Recognize how much we actually have in common and how deeply we need one another to preserve our shared values and methods and indeed our common planet. It may surprise you that I'm actually going to end with hope, on a note of hope, and it's hope that my own recent experience confirms. Over the last year since the book came out, I've been on the road almost every week. I think there were 2 weeks that I didn't travel, but otherwise I've been on the road pretty much nonstop and doing lots of radio and whatnot. Anyway, talking to varied audiences across academic disciplines, different kinds of community groups, you know, all kinds of audiences around the country about this existential threat to democracy. And I will tell you that when I started this, I was a little scared because I didn't want to be the voice of doom and gloom. And I have been so gratified and so inspired that what I've seen is coming from people of, you know, all kinds of domains, but a kind of passion and a deepening awareness that we are at this pivotal moment in our history, that we are at an all-hands-on-deck emergency for the very notion, let alone the future, of government of, by, and for the people. That awareness I have seen crosses sectors, from unionists to environmentalists, from feminists to civil rights activists, from good government groups to senior citizens who worked hard to build a fairer world and are appalled by the notion.
You've been listening.
Would inherit. We are seeing this in the Red for Ed teachers mobilizations that began in West Virginia, spread to Arizona, spread to Oklahoma, spread to my own North Carolina, and beyond. We are seeing this in the rise of indivisible groups around the country. We are seeing this in the rise of Our Revolution. We are seeing this in the growth of DSA. We're seeing this in the Parkland students who said to their parents, they said, oh, come on, wasn't it enough that we had to teach you to use your cell phones? Now we got to teach you to use your democracy? We are seeing a spirit that says we can do this and we must. It is out there. And that sense of urgency, I think, comes too with a recognition that we cannot just keep doing the same things in the same way and expect different results, right? We have to get out of the silos. We have to get in a common conversation. We have to change the national conversation, and we have to reform democracy to save it. Thank you. Been doing your part here. We are so impressed. Everybody I know is buzzing about that 2-1 victory over the right to work legislation.
You've been listening to Nancy McLean, author of Democracy in Chains, speaking at the UMKC Student Union in Kansas City, Missouri on August 11th as part of KKFI's Kicking the Coke Habit Conference. We're going to hear some messages, and then we'll be back with some of the Q&A.
So, my question deals with Chile mm-hmm. and then the Atlas Network. So,
yeah.
So you mentioned ALEC, but mm-hmm. and the statewide networks, but I guess they also have a city-county division and a worldwide division, the Atlas Network.
Yeah.
And so when you're talking about how hard it would be to change things, can you talk about what happened after Pinochet went in and they changed the constitution in Chile, and the troubles that they're having actually reinstating democracy down there?
Yeah, thank you so much for raising that. So I have a chapter in the book called The Constitution of Locks and Bolts, and it's a phrase that actually comes from Michelle Bachelet, the socialist elected whose family, she had actually been tortured, her father had been tortured, died in a Pinochet prison. during the era of the Pinochet military dictatorship. And it was a phrase that she used when she got into office in 2013. She had been elected by almost two-thirds of the Chilean people. I think it was 65% on a wide-ranging reform program after huge mobilizations by young people in particular, who were dealing with the fact that the privatization of education there made Chile's higher education system the most expensive in the OECD countries, and they had also privatized Social Security under the Pinochet dictatorship, resulting in disaster for people and their savings across Chile. Anyway, Michelle Bachelet had a wide-ranging reform program. She was elected, and she got into office, and she realized that she could not deliver on the program that she had promised the Chilean people because of this thing called the Constitution of Liberty. The Constitution of Liberty of 1980, which she said put locks and bolts on what the Chilean people could do. Now, that constitution is something, I tell the story of that constitution in chapter 10 of my book, and it was a surprise to me. It's been a surprise to many people who have studied Chile for years, because while many critics on the left of the Pinochet dictatorship knew about the role that Milton Friedman and the University of Chicago, sometimes called the Chicago Boys, the role they played in Chile in the 1970s, almost no one knew that Buchanan's Virginia School of Political Economy actually had a more long-lasting effect. He was called in precisely because of his advocacy of the kind of constitution, you know, the restrictive constitution I was describing. He was called in 1980 after it was abundantly clear how brutal that dictatorship was, that they'd actually assassinated people in Washington, D.C. on Embassy Row and purged their universities and more. He was called in to advise on a constitution because they knew that they would have to go back to elected rule at some point. But they wanted to make sure that when they did, all of the radical changes that they had made when they had crushed the people's power would stay in effect. And so Buchanan advised on this document that became called the Constitution of Liberty, and it's still in effect today, and it's a virtually, scholars have said, legal scholars, a virtually unamendable charter, right? So that's what the Koch Network hopes to achieve with constitutional change in this country. So if you read the book, when you read that chapter, think of it in terms of that slogan of the National Archives that they have up on the gorgeous building that says past is prologue. That Chilean constitution of locks and bolts is the kind of thing they want to have here. Oh, and so the second part of the question was about the Atlas Network. So this has been a transnational cause since its conception in 1947. Buchanan is kind of a key player in this larger phenomenon of neoliberalism, free market fundamentalism that was launched by this group, the Mont Pelerin Society, in 1947. Today, though, there is a much more significant transnational organization carrying and trying to implement these ideas, and that is the Atlas Network. The Atlas Network has, I believe now, it's 496 affiliates operating in 96 countries around the world pushing this agenda. So you can actually, if you look up Atlas Network, you can go to the country, click down, and find the organizations that are working on this. And this is actually, again, it's horrible, shocking, but it's also a crazy resource because once people know about this, they understand where things are coming from. I think I'm going to stop talking here, but if anybody's interested in more on this Atlas Network, there's some really great ways that it's now being used by environmentalists to kind of flip the script. So anyway, look for that. Yes.
I'm going to start by saying thank you for your hard work.
Thank you.
My question is, it's a lot less about your book and more about how you stay motivated. Maybe you answered at the end, but trying to stay motivated when you just want to step back from reality? I'm just curious about that. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a wonderful question, and I think it's really important that we all learn to pace ourselves, right? So I love that question, especially from someone who's maybe one of the younger people in the room who's thinking about the marathon that you're entering. I guess I'd say there are two things about these people. Never let them take away your joy, and never let them take away your hope, right? So you got to find ways to sustain those. I think one of the ways we keep those going is building communities, not being isolated, right? So what you're trying to do here with this gathering, with that calendar, with all the other ways, with bringing music and arts into your meetings, That stuff is really, really important in sustaining. Friendships are important, things you're passionate about, getting out of nature, whatever. I mean, seriously, I think we all need to think about marathon. I was actually, we talked in the earlier session about Uncoke My Campus and the great work that they're doing, and I was at one of their national meetings, and they actually had at the end for their activists a session, I didn't go to it, we left earlier, but on self-care, right? So I don't know what your thing is, like, you know, a Friday night Netflix binge, a warm bath, a walk through the woods, whatever, but make sure that you get that, because it's also, it's going to be crucially important in the work that we're undertaking that we maintain a kind of balance and composure and a capacity to have very reasoned discussions with people, because the right benefits, when everybody's screaming epithets at one another, right, and we're angry and we can't communicate, they win, because they know they're afraid of that majority. Keep that in mind. They're afraid of that majority. So if we can keep our own selves, you know, together and working well and get into, as the wonderful black feminist says, Bernice Johnson Reagan, she says, how did she put it in this great piece about coalition building? She said, if you're not feeling the strain, you're not doing the work. You know? Now, we have to get into conversations with some people. It's going to be pretty uncomfortable, but that's the work that we need to do. And to do that uncomfortable work, you got to sustain yourself. So thank you for that really wonderful question.
I would add that at all the women's conferences I've been to lately, there's been mandatory yoga.
That's great.
I have a technical question. Mm-hmm. You made a big deal out of a possible constitutional convention, mm-hmm. and it certainly would be a big deal, but clearly the delegates to that convention would be very, very important. Mm-hmm. And how do the Koch boys and their allies proposed to control the selection of delegates to a constitutional convention by controlling a majority of states that would then select the delegates?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. If you go to the Constitution and you look up Article 5, you'll see it's there's not a lot of text there. So essentially, the state legislatures who have authorized this could be choosing the delegates, right? And they've got 30. They're very organized. Our side has not thought about this at all, much less organized itself. So they would come in ready and able to dominate. Some of them are also trying to say that this constitutional convention would be restricted to considering a balanced budget amendment, which is something that polls well until people realize that it would mean the end of ongoing programs people care a great deal about, like Social Security and Medicare. But the other thing, all serious legal scholars say, you couldn't restrict the agenda of such a convention. There's no mechanism for doing that. So the assembled delegates would decide the agenda, and they would also decide the process for ratification. So it's basically the metric is 2/3 of the states would have to call that, which is this 34 number now, and then 3/4 of the states would have to ratify. But here again, the people at the convention would be determining the ratification process. Right? So it's really quite a can of worms, to the point where even conservative justices like Warren Berger said, this would be crazy, you shouldn't do that. So it is quite alarming, but there's lots of technical details to be dealt with. But I think the most important thing is alerting as many people as possible that this, you know, this is the real action. Donald Trump's over here with the shiny objects distracting our attention, and that's where the real action is. And Brett Kavanaugh, you know, the hearings are going to start probably after Labor Day. So I think it's really important that we focus on the courts. And I can say, too, Common Cause has done the best job of tracking this. So if you're interested in more about this constitutional convention question, Common Cause, their website is a great source of information.
Okay. If you have a question, you have to come up here.
One last thing I'll say on that, too. I'm trying in some of the work that I'm doing to engage more people in the legal academy in thinking about this and more, you know, practicing attorneys. But so if anybody knows folks in law schools, I think we should really get law schools buzzing about this, because I think most of them would be horrified. But because this isn't coming from the snotty, you know, universities who, like, you know, the Harvards and Princetons and Yales and the ones they pay attention to, they don't take it seriously because it's coming from, like, George Mason and all these other places. And it's like, You don't understand. If ideas have powerful, wealthy sponsors, they can change the world, whether you think they're significant or not. And that's exactly what we're seeing. Our judiciary is being transformed by this cause, by people from places like George Mason.
Hi.
Hi.
First, I wanted to say, I think your Bill Maher appearance has lit all sorts of people up.
Thank you.
And I've still been walking around in a bit of a daze from it, as have many of my friends. I live in Kansas. Uh-huh. And there's been all this stuff going on, you know, with our education system and the Supreme Court mm-hmm. saying that, you know, that things need to change. And then there's this movement to, you know, move the power away from the court. Uh-huh. Is that part of this whole thing? Is that smells pretty funny to me?
To move the power away from which courts?
From the state Supreme Court terms of determining what needs to be done for education.
Right. Yeah, this is a really interesting point that you raise, that this is happening in state after state, including my own North Carolina. These guys are pushing through such an unpopular agenda, they can get away with it because they've gerrymandered so much. As one journalist in North Carolina wrote, these guys could legislate that we all have to wear our underwear on the outside of our clothes and be safe because of the margins they put in. Now, that's not true. There's a push now to break the majority so they don't have a veto-proof majority. But it is pretty true that they've gerrymandered significantly so that the main force blocking them has been the courts. And the courts have actually been pretty good about a lot of the issues and pushing back on this effort, including the schools stuff. So they are taking direct aim at how the courts are chosen and nominated. And again, our national media is, and it's not partly their fault, partly they don't have journalists on the ground to do a lot, but also they're so distracted by Donald Trump that in state after state, we're on the verge of losing an independent judiciary to these state legislatures, and they're not covering it. So North Carolina faces the same thing. They're trying to take powers away from the courts. They're trying to change the courts. They're trying to do all kinds of stuff. So I would say watch your state courts closely and try to draw as much attention to what's happening as possible, because we really need them to be at least speed bumps to all this while we get ourselves organized and ready to deal with it. Thank you for that.
Thank you so much. I am thinking about wanting to hear you talk about a plan for diffusing this rapidly. And I'm thinking about how, whether you teach classes online, and if you have study circles that are working with this material, for example, is there any way of diffusing that? I'm also thinking of, do you know the work that David Orr is doing with...
I just joined their advisory board.
Oh, great. I'm just curious about your plan for diffusing this. And I'm thinking about how, like, 135 people in Kansas City went to a framing workshop a dozen years ago. We read the book Don't Think of an Elephant.
Oh, that's a great book. George Lakoff,
And I'm just thinking about, you know, that I think all the time about those people and how do we diffuse this more broadly and stay like in study circles, or what kind of model you're thinking of?
Thank you for that. I really do believe that this could be reversed, but I think it's going to be really, really intense work, right? And as a friend of mine likes to say, Dan Cano from the Working Families Party, you know, it took us 40 years to get this week. It's going to take a while to build our way out of it. But I think that we can do that. I don't think it relies so much on me. I mean, I'm certainly trying to go around and do the best I can to alert people to this, but at the end of the day, I'm a historian. I don't really represent anybody. I feel guilty that I'm not doing some of the things that you described doing, although I am going to try to come up with discussion questions for the book. And the press will actually give, if people get the book and they give it out, it's half price, you know, a shot. So that could make it more usable, you know, in study groups or in organizational networks and things like that. And then I can also say that I am working with a group that's come together that's working on a multi-organization, multi-state, multi-year project to unchain democracy, focusing on the states, that would come in with a must-have package of democracy reforms, pro-democracy reforms. It's akin to the kind of work that Jim Hightower and others are doing with Our Revolution, but basically to hold state-level democratic office holders, when they get elected, responsible to do the things that we need them to do to make our democracy work for the people. Again, so independent redistricting, addressing money in politics, having same-day voter registration, you know, all these kinds of things can be done to turn things around. But I think also this is a situation in which there is no magic bullet, right? We have got to rebuild our civil society and our organizations and our relationships with one another and our capacities to deal with this thing. I think we can. I think if every person in this room, and I'm saying this in many rooms, so I think, you know, it seems to be having some effect, but if every person in this room stopped and kind of inventory who's in your networks, who do you know? You know, here in your own city, across the state, people you went to school with, maybe people who are in your congregation, if you're a person of faith, people who are in your union, people, you know, we all know people that we can reach out to and we can alert, right, and share information with. We all know people who maybe with the right nudge in a one-on-one meeting might get active, who aren't active now. That's the way we've all got to start thinking. Because again, Buchanan was right. Forget about the rulers a little bit. Not forget, but don't focus on these silly discussions of who's going to be the presidential candidate in 2020. I say, who cares? We got much more work to do in the near time. And if we think about how am I going to contribute to the change, right, then I think we'll really start to get somewhere. So I think that's pretty crucial.
We've had two outstanding plenary speeches. Very interested last night in Stanley's comments about fascism, mm-hmm. those 10 characteristics. And then your comments in terms of the this conspiratorial far-right, neo-libertarian, et cetera, approach. How would you put those together? How would you integrate mm-hmm. those two? Because it seems to me that they resonate profoundly.
That's a great, great question. So the first thing I'd say, though, that is really important to understand is actually this Koch thing is not a conspiracy. By at least the technical legal definition, because a conspiracy by definition involves illegality, right? These guys are so rich that they can hire the best legal talent to stay on the bright side of the law, with the possible exception of nonprofit tax law, where I think they're hugely vulnerable, and that's why they went after Obama's IRS so aggressively. But basically, they're doing what they're doing legally, and the problem is we don't even have a word for this, a concept in the social sciences, because it is such an outrageous power grab. It would not be happening if we had not allowed wealth to get to the point where there are multi-billionaires like the Kochs for whom a couple hundred million dollars is pocket change. You know, it's just like, sure, we'll try that. If it doesn't work, we'll try this over here. But is this concerted action by very determined actors who often work in secret at meetings from which they exclude the press, and they even make sure their own participants leave their cell phones at the door so nobody can record? Yes, that's the kind of thing we're dealing with. We just don't have a concept for it because it is so audacious and it is so large scale and messianic. So it is a really big deal. And I do believe that for the people who are the key architects of this, I think that what they're most concerned with, as was Buchanan when he intervened in the massive resistance in Virginia in the late 1950s, I think the political economic questions are uppermost in their head, like how are they going to get this constitution they want, how are they going to get this complete economic liberty to the point that I think of it as property supremacy. But from the beginning, they have shown a willingness to strategically use racism and any other prejudice that serves their purposes. So I actually have a chapter called Letting the Chips Fall Where They May, which was Buchanan's language when he leveraged the white supremacy of Virginia in this era in order to try to get privatization of the schools. So what we see now with the Koch network is, again, you gotta, once you get these dynamics, a lot of people have written me and said that they get it now. You know, like it's much easier to sort of see what's going on and navigate this world because these guys aren't popular. This agenda is not popular. So how do they move that agenda? They move that agenda by getting larger numbers into action. He used to be honest and say he was radical, Charles Koch, in the 70s. Wouldn't have anybody around him who was not radical. Absolute contempt for conservatives when they founded the Cato Institute. Stuff that would have made conservatives' hair stand on an end if they knew what was being said about them. But now they say they're conservative. Why? Because that's where the votes are. And where are the votes among conservatives that are the most energetic and active? The religious right, right? The issues around abortion and homosexuality and racism. So, particularly, the whole notion that there's mass voter fraud, that is based on an assumption. It is strategic racism to get white people to think, oh yeah, what are all these Black and Latino voters doing electing people? How'd they get a president? That must have been illegitimate, right? So that and get them to support voter suppression. Similarly, the anti-immigrant stuff, they push those buttons very hard. So Demos has talked about this, and particularly their brilliant past president, Heather McGee, the strategic use of racism to move this agenda. So I think that's a place where Jason and my work come together, as he's talking about kind of the habits of mind and of organizing that get the base going, whereas I'm focusing more, you could almost say, like behind the curtain, you know, at like the big design and what the, you know, the real architects and strategists of this are doing, but they can't get where they're going without that strategic use of misinformation with climate science, voter alleged voter fraud, and the rest, and prejudice, so that you have to see it all together, I think, to get a full understanding.
And that's about all the time we're going to have. You've been listening to Nancy McLean, author of Democracy in Chains, recorded on August 11th here in Kansas City as part of the Kicking the Coke Habit Conference.